Okay, thanks very much. So it's very nice to be back here again and gradually talking about various aspects of non-commutative geometry every time I come. But I'm particularly, this is the quantum gravity seminar, and I'm particularly interested in quantum gravity. What I'm trying to do is use non-commutative geometry to do quantum gravity. So the non-commutative geometry I'm interested in is based around the Dirac operator. And the interesting thing for me is this, so there's a mathematical framework for this due to Alain Kohn. The interesting thing for me is that this makes sense still if H is a finite dimensional vector space or Hilbert space. So if H finite dimensional, this is okay. But you have a non-commutative geometry. Well, actually, I mean, you don't have to have a non-commutative geometry. You can do commutative geometry, and then in this setting, you're just talking about a lattice theory, a finite set of points. And so there's a finite number of field values. But we don't want to do lattice theory, so we want to do the other thing, which is non-commutative geometry. And then in this setting, you can do various physics-like things. You can do quantum geometry now. And this is what we do. You can just write down a functional integral over your Dirac operators and some action and integrate over the space of Dirac operators. So you have some well-defined space here. And these D's are just matrices. So this is just a matrix model of some sort. There's some constraints that tell you the matrix is actually a Dirac operator. And the whole point is that this is eminently well-defined and computable and so on. And we do this. I mean, we put this on a computer and compute such things and have lots of interesting results about how this thing behaves.
Where the S comes from the spectrum
droplet? S is just the action of some sort. I mean, you can just pick an action. And as long as this integral here converges, then you're fine. So we have some particular choices of action which we like. Actually, not the spectral action, not the well, they're spectral in a general sense, but not the Kohn-Chamserlin spectral action. So anyway, so I've been doing this project with Lisa Glaser, for example, and there's one paper out on what you get from such a thing, and there's more papers to come. But so what I want to talk about today is a sort of more classical problem, or more mathematical problem, which is can these non-commutative geometries really approximate ordinary geometries? So can a finite, meaning finite dimensional, non-commutative geometry approximate space-time? And of course, space-time, you have a Dirac operator, but now the Hilbert space that it acts on is infinite dimensional. It's the space of sections of spinors on your space-time. And I'm saying Hilbert space here. Everything I'm talking about is Euclidean, so there's a Hilbert space. It's a convenience. And the answer that I'm going to present is yes, for some so far, for space-time M, for M equals a co-joint orbit. Of a semi-simple Lie group. Whether that's all you can do, I don't know. And to get this result, you pick a, some, you make some choices along the way. You pick something to do with the Lie group, obviously, to put in the framework, and then you turn the handle, and out comes the cojoint orbit. Whether it's possible to have a more general result that doesn't mention Lie groups and cojoint orbits, but just has manifolds more generally, I don't know yet. So that's a very interesting project. More generally, question mark. So I'm going to present some of the technical detail for this result, so I'll get more technical as time goes on. And at some so I'll start off talking about this problem in general, but at some point I'll go to the Lie group case here with the aim of at least stating it precisely what this result actually is. But I want you to bear in mind that it's part of a sort of more general question, which is not necessarily anything to do with Lie groups. Okay, so that was the intro. Yeah, question.
May I ask whether we consider space-time Euclidean or Lorentzian?
Euclidean at the moment, Euclidean. Yeah. Yeah, so this is, as usual, for technical convenience. And not least because a lot of the technical issues with Lorentzian haven't actually been addressed yet in this framework. So.
They're not been addressed by Kohn either.
Right. Well, he has a philosophical objection to addressing them, but I don't. Yes. Okay. So, so what are we talking about? We're talking about what order did I have this in? Yeah, so let's talk more technically. Finite spectral triples, that's what this thing is. So A is a star algebra. Over C or R. Doesn't terribly matter which. H is a Hilbert space. And the finite here means that this is finite dimensional. So everything I'm going to say is true without the finite on, and you miss off this finite dimensional. But then there's some more conditions which I'm not going to say. So I want a representation of A in the Hilbert space. So map to the endomorphisms of H. So this is a left action.
And A really is a star algebra, not
C star algebra? So it's a star algebra, not C star. No, just a star algebra. Well, of course, in finite dimensions, every star algebra is a C star algebra, but in the infinite dimensional case, no. And this is what should be star, unitary, as it were. And we have another map called the real structure. And it's antilinear. And the square of it is plus or minus one, with a different sign depending on which dimension you're in. And the most important thing that comes with this real structure, this is, by the way, this is like charge conjugation in ordinary space-time physics. You should think of it as, like charge conjugation. The most important thing is that there's a condition that says that if I take the action of A star, or A in fact, doesn't matter, and I conjugate with J, and this commutes with the original action, rho B. So in other words, the algebra actually acts twice on the Hilbert space, and these two actions commute with each other, i.e. A maps to J. Is a right action. Commuting with the left action. Right.
This says.
Yes.
Is the vanishing of the commutator a condition or a consequence or something?
It's an axiom. This is what I'm giving you the definition here. Yeah.
Do we assume the representation is faithful, or do you not care?
Best to assume it's faithful.
So it's like left, right, bimodule.
Yes. So what this tells you is that H is a bimodule. Bimodule. That's the math speak. Over A. And this J interchanges left action and right action. Now, this seems like a very strange mathematical structure, except that this is what you get in particle physics. So particle physics has the fermions form a bimodule. Particle physics. Fermions are a bimodule. Bimodule. Over an algebra, which is something to do with the gauge theory. Some sort of gauge algebra, if you like. Just be vague, like this. And this point of view, this bimodule point of view, delivers you the usual list of charges and so on in the standard model. I mean, you'll know that, that all the fields in the standard model have one, two, or three charges. Under U1, SU2, and SU3. But if you rearrange the U1 in the right way, take linear combinations, then you can write it in such a way that every field has exactly two charges. And that is because it's a bimodule. So there's lots of experimental evidence for this structure here. Although it seems surprising from a point of view of, perhaps mathematical point of view, when you just start. Yeah. And I actually want to write this right action sort of schematically. So in other words, I want to write that if I have J rho A star J inverse acting on some vector in the Hilbert space, then I actually want to write that. It's just a definition, a notational definition, as it acting on the right. Okay. So the usual action is on the left, and this is on the right, and it's nice notation because then you can remember that they commute. Okay. Go set everything. Oh, right, okay. No, not quite. What am I missing? Okay, so the thing I'm missing, which I should have left space for, is the Dirac operator. Can people see down in the corner here? Is that okay? D is self-adjoint. And it commutes with J. And then there's another condition which I really am going to have to go to. The next board, I guess. The most important condition is the following condition. So So if I take the commutator with the left action and commute again with the right action, I get zero. And this goes by the fancy name of the first order condition. And it's the appropriate generalization in non-commutative geometry of the condition that tells you the Dirac operator is a first order differential operator. And I'll explain that a bit in a minute. Well, morally, you can think of it the following way, that if... So actually, the message of my talk today is you shouldn't think of this like this, but if you do think of it like this, if you think of these as functions on your sort of non-commutative space, then the commutator of D with a function is a zeroth order operator. In other words, it's multiplication by something. And then if this is more functions, then this commutes with that, and you get zero. Okay, so that's the...
So when you said that in body physics is actually three-dimensional, right, in the space of the Hilbert space of polynomials is three-dimensional.
Yeah, that's right. So you don't have this finite thing here. You have all the same structure here. But then you need to say some more things because it's infinite dimensional. You need to say something about that you have unbounded operators. You need to say something about the domains and about the resolvent and things. So there's all that to cope with the infinite dimensional stuff. But otherwise, this is all the same.
But still, I'm still surprised that in three dimensions, you still want to only start algebra as opposed to...
Yeah.
So that's a difference, right?
Yeah, actually, because this is the algebra of smooth functions in the infinite dimensional case. So it's not complete. It's not a C star algebra. Okay, so I now want to talk about the limits. Well, I want to talk about the commutative case now, since I've just been saying, talk about a manifold, but here's the commutative case. E.g. a manifold. So obviously it's not finite dimensional. And as I said just now, there's some more axioms of an analytic nature, which I'm just going to ignore. But there's an extra condition. Which is that the left actions and the right action are the same. So, so that condition for all A in the algebra. So this is the right action, this is the left action. And obviously this only makes sense in the commutative case because a right action and a left action are different things. They're associative, and the associativity involves swapping them over to get the associativity of the other one. So only in the commutative case does that even make sense to state this as an axiom. But of course, if these two things are equal, then this first order thing just collapses. It just tells you that with a single action, you really have the first order condition. And then it's honestly what I said just now. This is a Dirac operator on a manifold now, and you commute with a function here, and that gives you just the gradient of that contracted with gamma matrices, and then that commutes with more functions. You get zero. So this is the honest first order condition on a manifold. So that's why this generalization is called the first order condition.
By non-dimensionality, you refer to the dimensionality of the manifold or the algebra, dimensionality of the algebra of function?
Dimensionality of the Hilbert space.
Oh, okay.
So, H not dimensional. So here, H is L2 of spinners. Sections. Of the infinite dimension. And of course, this condition here is now vacuous because this, this just says that this is now row A and this is row B, and it just says that row A and row B commute, so it's commutative algebra. So the question is, how does the limit work? Now, if you sort of... What people say... Perhaps I shouldn't say this, because this is... Now I'm saying it twice, I'm saying the wrong thing, which is that people like to think of this as some sort of non-commutative algebra of functions. And that turned out to be misleading, because if you think of the limit... You might, that point of view would lead you to believe that this algebra in the limit just becomes commutative in the limit. And then you'll get some version of this thing here with commutative axioms, but it wouldn't be exactly this thing here, because this extra condition wouldn't pop out. There would be nothing to guarantee this extra condition. You'd get some sort of non-commutative geometry with a commutative geometry, which is a funny thing. And it turns out that in the examples that I know how to do now, that's not how it works. This algebra doesn't just suddenly become commutative in the limit. And a reason you can point to is to look at the transformations. So in the commutative setting, a transformation is a diffeomorphism here of the manifold. And in the non-commutative setting, you're talking about an automorphism of the algebra that is induced by something on the Hilbert space and so on. So if A is unitary, in other words, A star is A inverse, then this mapping that takes a vector in the Hilbert space to sort of adjoint action, that's an action of a group. Call this U psi of group of transformations. And in the limit, you want this to go to the diffeomorphisms. I'm going to say this very roughly. You want U to go to, in this limit, a diffeomorphism.
Just to make sure that, so when you talk about commutative case, A should always be infinite.
Well, you could have a finite set of points.
For your talk.
For my talk, yes. Yeah, in lattice theory, you'd have a finite, but I don't want to talk about it.
And then the rho of A in that case is just the function in the set.
It's the multiple, yeah, so I should say more here then. A is the C infinity of this, and rho means multiplying functions with spinners. Rho A, sorry.
But
like,
Minita Goyo said that A is not commutative, but...
This is commutative, yeah.
So, it is
commutative. Yeah, sure, this is a commutative case, yeah. But you see the problem here. If I want to take a limit of non-commutative gadgets and take them to commutative things, then if I'm not careful, all my transformations will disappear. Because in the commutative case, these two actions are the same. So I can put this on this side here, and then they just cancel. You get one. So there's no such formula in the commutative case. And so if in my limit, I just make the algebra go to a commutative algebra, all of these diffeomorphisms will go to the identity, and there won't be any. So so I want to do something more sophisticated. Let's look at the infinitesimal version. So this is, you just obviously take small a here. This is, and you get a commutator. We'll take a is 1 plus, yeah. So replace here. This take 1 plus epsilon times a prime, take epsilon small, and then you get this formula here. And I can write this suggestively as a commutator. So you see, commutators generate transformations of the space, and I want to preserve them to survive in the limit and become diffeomorphisms. So I want to call this thing V of A. So V of A. This is called V of A. This map here. So this is V, this is.
Isn't there still a subtlety that the algebra is this V A algebra is a space function and diffeomorphism is generated by vector field?
Yeah.
So,
right. So I want to call this thing here a vector field. This is some non-commutative analog of a vector field. So you see here, when we first said, if you fix with the idea this is a non-commutative algebra of coordinates, you're kind of making a mistake because it also tells you about the vector fields. You see. So it plays two roles. There's vector fields hidden in here. So I think this is all well known, but here's the new bit. So that can go up, I guess. So here's the new idea. We can define what I want to call non-commutative coordinates, or functions or something. So this is really how I think you should think. So I'm going to call this x of a. And this takes psi to rho a psi plus psi. In other words, the anti-commutator. So my claim is that this is the thing that becomes the algebra of coordinates in the commutative case. Here. So paradoxically, perhaps, the thing that's called rho in the commutative case is going to be the limit of what I'm calling x here in the non-commutative case. You see, so the non-commutative case had two actions. It's a bimodule. It left action and right action. And the commutative case just has one action. So how do you get two into one? Well, you take linear combinations. The difference of them is the vector fields, and the sum of them is the single action in the commutative case. So my limit, this sum of the left and the right actions will converge to the commutative algebra, and the difference will stay alive and become the vector fields in the limit. Here's a nice thing, a nice property. If I can calculate the I mean, this isn't a left action, but if I thought of it as a left action and I now calculate the right action correspondingly using the same formula as I used before for rho, then you can see I just get that, but the J just interchanges left and right actions. So this is just the same thing, but with the two terms swapped over. Whoops, left term. So you notice that this equation here is automatically the sought after extra funny extra condition that you have in the commutative case. And of course you're used to this in the commutative case. It tells you charge conjugation just acts at a point. And if this is a function here and you commute with charge conjugation, you just get the complex conjugate function. So, you know, so it's a perfectly standard thing. So it satisfies already satisfies commutative condition for coordinates. Okay, so the idea for the limit is the XA commute in the limit. So they generate the algebra of functions on M, i.e. this is rho in the commutative case. But the VAs become the vector fields. Okay. So that's that. So you see, you can think of this in the following way. Another way of thinking about what I've said is that there's two copies of the algebra. So A plus A acts on H. So a pair of elements, A and B, so all I've done is taken linear combinations of the left and the right action, so I can undo that. In other words, row A, one acts on the left, and the other acts on the right. Be careful with the signs. And in the limit is a contraction. And this is a technical term in Lie algebra representation theory. You have a contraction of representations or Lie algebra. So the diagonal elements are unchanged. But the some constant times the anti-diagonal elements commute. And in the limit, it precisely C goes to zero, which is how this works. Okay, so you can sort of see what the problem is, which is, you know, to now build a mathematical theory to make this limit work. And
so what do you mean by a limit of an algebra there? But you need to have a parameter or
yeah.
So you have a finite dimensional algebra.
Yeah.
So you just have an algebra. You cannot take a limit. N is fixed.
You're just asking the question I'm about to ask, which is how do I take this limit? Because the problem is in this limit, this algebra gets larger. Assuming the Hilbert space is getting larger and larger, because it's trying to converge to an infinite dimensional Hilbert space for your manifold, then these algebras here are getting larger and larger. And then the question is, what does it mean for this to converge?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I think there is such a theory, or should I say there will be such a theory. I think there are elements of it actually exist, but it's not something that I know how to put together in a coherent way at the moment.
Maybe an infinite dimensional manifold is a way of taking them. Given, right? This notion of limit is not unique. It depends on
there's
so many ways of taking this nested.
That's right. There's probably lots of ways of taking limits, and each way will give you a different manifold in the limit. Yes, that's right. Absolutely. But I do know how to do a particular case, and that's what I'm going to explain for the rest of the time. Which is when there's a fixed Lie algebra around. So, purely to make progress, and for no other good reason, fix a Lie algebra. And a homomorphism into my something's missing. Phi. It's a homomorphism. And I'm thinking of my algebra A for my spectral triple as a Lie algebra just by taking commutators, obviously. And now I want to get a bit more, want to say a bit more about the limit. So I'm going to think of a sequence of these things indexed with n. Do I mean n? Do my notes say k? No, my notes say k, so I'm going to try and stick with k. Yeah, so I'm going to have a sequence now of these finite spectral triples. So a sequence. Hilbert space K, algebra K, Dirac operator K, real structure K. Representation K. And now there's the K-th homomorphism. So L is fixed all the time. So it's like there's a fixed sort of symmetry algebra lying around. Well, it doesn't have to be symmetry. It's just a fixed sort of background algebra hanging around.
Those homomorphisms are interpreted to be like copies of the same one,
Well, sequence, no, you see, the idea is these algebras are getting bigger and bigger as I run my sequence. Want them to become infinite dimensional. So this is fixed, so there's just one for each k. And I want to compare these as I run the sequence, so I want to have injections. Ik, going from hk to hk plus one. And it means I can compare operators in one space with the operators in the next space by just pushing them through this injection. Okay, so if I have a Dirac operator on here, I can also think of it as acting on here by I go backwards by projecting onto the image of this thing here, do the Dirac operator here, and then inject back into here. So I can essentially think of all the operators as happening in one space. I can even take the limit of them all and have them act on the final thing at the end. And I'm going to have constants. C, N, ZK, ZK. Which, as I said before, will go to zero in the limit. And now I'm going to do the scaling that I talked about vaguely here before. So I'm going to talk big V of the Lie algebra element L. So L's in the Lie algebra. Is this little v that I had here, this non-commutative vector field, just on the nose. So it's little v of 5L. And the coordinates, this is n, so it's n on here. The coordinates are going to lead to a big x, so the nth coordinate operator. And this is where I put the scaling in. So I'm going to have little x, phi n of L. And I'm going to put in a constant c. So, n, not n, k, k. I have notes, some of which have n and some k, so these are all k. Arg. And you now can compute the commutators of these things. So let's do that. And what you find is the following. K. So it's basically the just two copies of the Lie algebra L, but written in a basis where you've taken sums and differences of the two copies. So you see the effect of the scaling I put in here, and by the way, I put in an I here to make it Hermitian. The effect of the scaling, you see this term here, there's two x's. So if I multiply the equation through by c squared, the c's on here are absorbed to make the little x's into big x's, and on here they remain. Whereas here it's homogeneous in the scaling, so that it doesn't appear in those equations. So the key point is that when you do the contraction, this goes off to zero, and then this term vanishes, and these x's commute. And these are now the coordinates in the limiting case. Okay, so where shall I put the limit? Over here, I guess. Just wrote on that, so down here. So the limit Okay, so you just see the exit. Zero and V infinity act by Diffiez. Infinitesimal diffeomorphisms. So the limiting algebra, A infinity, is polynomials in the X infinity. So you can actually construct it kind of from this sort of Cauchy sequence of spectral triples. You can actually construct this thing here. And obviously you can take H infinity as being the union of all the HKs, where you include, obviously, you include them all in each other, so the thing telescopes.
You have to eliminate states that are such that X, you know, because the action of X on psi will grow when you send theta to zero. So
yeah.
You have to make sure that.
That's right. That's right. So the whole idea is that this becomes large. This little x becomes large in the limit, and this becomes small, and the whole thing is balanced so that it converges. Yeah. So you have to be careful. Sure.
You have to be careful that it doesn't become large.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes. So,
which might not be true for other states. Right? It's not guaranteed.
It's not guaranteed, that's right. So, where's my statement? Yeah, so the way the limit works is the following. You have a statement that xn minus x infinity. Okay, thank you. Acting on psi, the modulus of this goes to zero for all psi in H infinity. And you complete this, make the Hilbert space completion of this. So you also find that the X infinity are bounded operators, so everything is nice. This is called strong convergence here. It's not uniform. Things converge at a different rate depending on different size in the limiting Hilbert space. So roughly speaking, if you have a vector that has stuff in it which is significant at a very large k, then it's converges later than a vector for which it has stuff in a small k. Typical.
You're saying that
we
ensure the convergence of the V?
Yeah, so the V is a bit more tricky, but the V's are preserved actually, so the V's commute with the action. So actually that convergence is, so they're more tricky because they're unbounded and they're going to an unbounded operator. But they're much easier to see explicitly what's going on because they simply commute. There's no scaling going on here. So This preserves the Lie algebra exactly on the nose. So you just have the same Lie algebra acting. So let's think of an example here. So if I take fuzzy S2, I can converge to the ordinary Riemannian S2. Yeah, let me tell you. So the Hilbert space is you have a fixed spinor space, so C to some power, and I've used n and k, so q tensor matrices. That's just going to be k. So this just means k by k matrices. The kth algebra is k k by k matrices. And the two actions, well, the action. So a typical element in here is some spinner. This is your standard space of spinners, Dirac spinners in dimension Q. So you have some spinner V tensor matrix M, and the action is just to multiply matrices. And there's a nice calculation. You can show that the right action is just multiplying on the right. Once I've told you what J is, of course, I'll tell you in a minute, that's just J of psi. No, J of V tensor M. This is the standard charge conjugation matrix on the spinner and the Hermitian conjugate on the matrix. You would write dagger if you were doing a physics thing, I guess. So it's all very explicit. Yeah?
Which topology do you use on the Hilbert?
These are all finite dimensional here, so...
Don't we get in the infinite dimensional Hilbert space for infinite?
Yeah, you get infinite. I'll tell you in a minute what it is exactly. Yes, thank you. Yeah. Well, you just take this vector space here, and then you just complete it, do the usual L2 completion. So it becomes a Hilbert space. Okay, and then what am I going to take for my... My Lie algebra is going to be SU2, and these homomorphisms here, so L is SU2, and the kth homomorphism from L to the algebra, which is k by k matrices, is to take the Lie algebra element in the k-dimensional irreducible. So, k-dimensional irreducible representation of SU2. So there is, in fact, a standard map that takes you from IK, takes you from HK to HK plus 1. which is not too hard to figure out. But basically, so if you think of this thing as a representation of SU2 across SU2, yeah.
Sorry to go back a little, but when you define this H sub K,
yeah.
Somehow it looks as if you were dealing with a trivial spinner bundle.
Yeah, right. It's a trivial bundle, yes.
But this is over the two-sphere. It wants to be over the...
Right.
So the tangent bundle is not trivial.
The Dirac spinner bundle is trivial.
Okay.
Yeah. The Weyl spinner bundle is not trivial, but I haven't told you how to project onto the Weyl spinners. So
at some point we would be able to do that?
Yeah, that's another story which I'm not going to get into. But yeah, you can do that. Okay, so let me just say there is a map, an obvious map here, and not spend too much time on that.
So in this construction, the Dirac operator doesn't play much of a role at all?
Right, at the moment it doesn't, yeah. So, but of course, right, but now I have all the machinery to say what to do with the Dirac operator, and if I have the kth Dirac operator, that's going to converge to the infinite one. So this is sort of the setup here, and then this is the punchline, that it's just going to converge in the same sense that these things converge here.
You were going to say something about the injection?
Well, I'm not going to spell out exactly what it is, but I might say later what it is. But there's an obvious injection. But, okay, there's an obvious injection that preserves the adjoint action, and that's the one. So this K by K matrices has an action of SU2 on the left and on the right. If you think of the adjoint action, where those two actions are the same copy of SU2, it decomposes into a Clebsch-Gordan series of spin 0, 1, so on, all the way up to n minus 1 or something. And you just preserve that adjoint action in this injection. That's what it is. Okay. So here's a nice exercise for your homework. You can show the following relations. And you have to be really careful about the order of the operators here. So I wrote the commutator relations on the board earlier. So these are the anti-commutator relations. A little bit more tricky, actually. And there's another one. And I haven't bothered to convert little b into big V for an obvious reason, that the arguments are not of the right sort. Anyway, you can just have fun with the algebra proving those relations from the definitions. But what you do with these... Sorry? Completely general, yeah, just at the kth level. but what I want to do is to apply this to the Casimir. So I put L1 and L2 equal here, and then sum over all three in these top and bottom equations. And of course, the nice thing is that phi of the Casimir is a standard number for SU2. It's the Casimir, the usual J plus 1, but J is converted to N, which is now K. This is big K, this Casimir. I knew it was N for a reason. Anyway, it's now K. Right, so... but V of something is a commutator, and this... You see, the point is this is a constant. This is times 1, if you like. And so this is 0 for the Casimir case. And up here... This I don't care. This is anti-commutator with a constant. So the constant survives, gets doubled. Right, because when I sum over L's here, this thing is just the Casimir. So what I get in the limit is the following equations. Yeah, so what I get is that's what this equation, the top equation becomes here. So this tells me exactly how C has to behave. So I want this to all to converge to 1. So my limiting equation now, I have sum of x li squared is 1. Is 1 to 3. Okay, this term will vanish because these converge. And this equation here, this thing on the right vanishes in the limit. And I just have, so this is the affinity thing. And the second equation becomes sum of x li, infinity, e infinity. Equals 0. So you can convince yourself, one, this is the equation of a sphere with commuting operators, so it's just they're just functions on some space. It's a sphere. This is the equation that tells you that the three standard vector fields on the sphere have a linear relation between them. So the tangent space is really only two-dimensional. So if you write your favorite expression for vector fields like this, and then you sum them, this turns into this formula like this, I think. Something like that. Okay, so it's the right equation for vector fields on the sphere. So finally, I want to talk about the general case. Something a bit more less trivial. So we have a semi-simple Lie algebra L. Which is the Lie algebra of a Lie group. G. And now we have a sequence n sub k. Now it comes into use. K is 1. And irreducible representations. So now in my sequence, the matrices, the size of the matrix jumps, you know, so you have irreducible representations of your Lie algebra, because you won't have one in every dimension anymore. And of course, we can think of this as C to the n k tensor, the dual space. What's my dual space notation? I put a bar on for that. Not quite sure why. So this thing here you get is a representation of the it's in the wrong place. Yeah, so remember you have two copies of the Lie algebra. And if this irreducible representation has highest weight, W, then L plus L here, acting on this and this, will have highest weight, W and minus W. That's the highest weight. See, because this is the complex conjugate space here, the lowest weight of this is the highest weight of... No, the lowest weight of that is the highest weight of the complex conjugate space. So that's the highest weight here. And how does the limit work? So the limit of CNK goes to infinity. And the weight vectors, WK, divided by NK, have to converge to some limiting weight vector, W infinity. So these are conditions, if you like, on the limit. You have to demand that this... So you've got a sequence of representations of these weights, and the weights are getting larger and larger, obviously, because you get the representation getting bigger. I divide by NK, and I want that to converge. So that's some weight in the dual of the Cartan subalgebra. Which by orthogonal stuff you can think of as living in the dual of the Lie algebra. And what you find, and I'm now quoting from a classic paper of Dooley and Rice from 19, a long time ago, you find that there's a sequence of inclusions into H infinity, and you can describe H infinity as L2 of some manifold M. So this is answering your question, whoever it was, about what is this completion? Well, the completion exactly completes to L2 of the manifold. What is the manifold? It's the coadjoint orbit under the Lie group of the limiting weight vector. Okay, so what's a coadjoint orbit? Well, you take L star and you take your weight vector, and then you just take the set of all points that G wraps it into. And obviously, what is that? Well, it's the group divided by the stability group of this thing here. And moreover, this weight W infinity determines a rep, a reducible representation of the semi-direct product of G semi-direct L. So what's L? Let's call it L twiddle. So L twiddle, it's the Lie algebra thought of as an abelian Lie group. So L as abelian Lie group. So the usual thing, just thinking of it as a vector space. So, right. And then, of course, G acts on this by the adjoint action. So that's the semi-direct product. So what is that? It's induced from a character which is e to the I W infinity of t. So that's a character on L twiddle here, and a trivial representation of the stabilizer. stabilizer of W or chi, same thing. So here's an example of another example. Well, the SU2 I did already is an example of that, of course. So I'm just about to finish. So this is the last slide, literally. So if I take the SU2 case, the L star is R3 here, and then the cojoint orbit is the 2-sphere. Exactly what we had. So let's just think of another example. We have one CP2. Then you have the root diagram for CP2 is sort of hexagonal. Now that's a pretty bad root diagram. Let's try again. These are the roots. And then the weights for the, so you pick a highest weight, and then I should use different colour, shouldn't I? So the weights all lie in this cone here. These are the dominant weights, which give you the irreducibles. And the point is, any point in this diagram can be W infinity. So, you know, if you want a particular W infinity here, you have to find your sequence of weight vectors. So the weight vectors do, what do? Something like this. And then there's more up here, and I don't know, something like that. You have to find a sequence that, when you rescale, converges to this point here. So a typical weight vector will give you a six-dimensional manifold. But if you go up exactly up this line here on the edge of this file chamber here, that's how you get CP2. So this sequence that goes up here is where CP2 lies.
What was the group in this case?
Sorry, what?
The group?
The group is SU3. Yeah, I should have said this. So CP2 is SU3 over SU2 cross U1. So anyway, you can mess around with root diagrams and just find your favorite spaces. Oh, there's just my final thing to say. What's the spinner space in this example? actually, I didn't even tell you what the spinner space was for the fuzzy sphere. There's actually two versions of the fuzzy sphere. In the original version, Q is equal to 2. And that's the Grosser-Presnado version. And Q equals 4 is my version, which is in a fairly recent paper, which has the chirality operator and answers the question about how you project out the spinners, the file spinners. Here, you take Q equals 8. And you get the spinners by, right, so there's a map of SU3 into SO6, which you can represent on 8-dimensional spinners. And that's how you get the trivial spinner bundle here for CP2. And that, as in this example, the spinners are doubled. This is 4 because you have 2 spinners at every point. And here again, it's doubled. In fact, you can't undouble it here because CP2 doesn't have a spin structure. So it's sort of essential. Oh, so the only other thing I didn't say is, what's the Dirac operator? Yeah, OK, so you're puzzled about what the Dirac operator is. So typically, in the non-commutative setting, it's the following formula. Some formula like this. So Lij are in the Lie algebra. And you think of that as living in some SOP, as in here, P with 6. And then when you're in SOP, you can think of the algebra elements as labeled by pairs of indices, and use the gamma matrices like this, like you do to generate spin rotations. Yeah, so that's the formula. And then in the limit, you just simply replace this commutator by the derivative. It's some vector field. And that gives you the Dirac operator on the cojoint orbit. OK, so I guess I should stop.
Oh, thank you. How is it related to anything quantum gravity? Because this manifold came out, we call it space time. This manifold, it's nothing to do with
right.
Any space time. Because in some sense, non commutative structures did not know anything about space time. So but my question, I mean, where are the sequence? I mean, usually you think of that you've got a planet or something, and then that. Goes to zero and then this emerges.
Yeah.
But here we have this limit in which by the discreteness, k.
Right. So I think of the size of the matrix as coding in the Planck scale. Or if you like, it's the ratio of the Planck scale to the cosmological scale. So we're talking huge matrices here, right? But in principle, they're finite dimensional. And the limit is the normal limit you take in. To go from quantum gravity to classical gravity, you say, well, let's send the Planck constant to zero. So the Planck constant is sort of 1 over k or something, 1 over n.
but is the ambition that, in fact, one is going to get something, maybe this is a special action or some action, that in such limit, one is actually going to recover some general relativity for something?
Yeah, that's the dream, of course.
So somehow, but then at each k, you have to specify what you're...
Right, well, each k, you'll do the same thing. It'll be some general formula and just apply the same...
Some action or something.
Yeah. I mean, the action we're using at the moment, because it works rather nicely, is this following thing. We just write the action of a Dirac operator is trace d4th minus... some coupling constant d squared. That's our action at the moment. And actually what happens is you tune g to get a phase transition.
Yes. That was my question.
And it appears that if you tune g to the phase transition and then you make the matrices get larger and larger, it becomes more and more classical. So this is all in a quantum model, of course, and it's difficult to address. So this is really addressing the sort of classical question, and how would I just, if I could sort of pick out a vacuum state for each one of these, and then take a sequence of the vacuum states as I made the matrices bigger and bigger. I guess what I'm trying to analyze here is how would that behave in the best possible world? Some question. Yeah.
Yeah. So it seems like there's something that's even better than what I thought is about to make, because you have this inclusion of the Hilbert spaces. So you can, you know, take any finite Hilbert space and still think of it as some nice subspace of L2 of your manifold in the end. And then
right.
You can look at your algebra, original algebra to a small size and think of it as actually acting on some subset of L2 of your manifolds, but now by operators which don't commute each other for a position, for example. So if you actually
yeah.
do this, does it give you anything interesting? Or, can you, for example, extend the algebra on your subspace of L2M for some finite k to all of L2M? Or is it,
yeah, sort of. I mean, so the way it works is when you have a finite dimensional representation of a Lie group, you can represent it by sections of a bundle on a cojoint orbit, sort of how this works. And those sections, you have to pick a particular bundle, and then there have to be holomorphic sections. So the way it works is that these inclusions preserve this condition, but in the limit, the holomorphic thing just disappears, and you just find that the whole thing in the limit is just dense in all the sections, and then there's no holomorphic thing anymore. So that's roughly how it works. So yeah, so you could probably go backwards and impose the holomorphic condition, and I don't understand how to do that, but I mean, so people do similar things like this, and they mumble about coherent states, and they say, oh, you start with a classical manifold, you put coherent states on it, and then you have a finite thing, and so on. So I think something like that is the backwards procedure, but I don't understand it in any technical sense.
In this prescription, this beautiful idea, the idea would be that you think of the degrees of freedom. The idea is that there's more and more degrees of freedom in some ways, right? You know?
Yeah.
Fundamentally, there's only certain degrees of freedom, and then we're idealizing more and more degrees of freedom, which is Hilbert space becoming bigger and bigger. So I think the idea here was to sort of embed, right? So there's some k which I embedded in the L2,
yeah.
So I'll get some subspace.
Yeah.
And then, but then on that subspace, however, the original system you have at the kth level,
yeah,
that doesn't act faithfully, right? Because here you just get x's with the commute and everything happens.
No, because it doesn't preserve all the actions.
Right.
I mean, the x action isn't preserved as you go from one member to the next.
Right.
So something, you know,
right.
It only converges to something. It doesn't.
Therefore, you're not really see everything.
Yeah,
the
right.
It's a beautiful idea, but maybe it's a good idea to see what you see. In the sense, there's a shadow that is left over a whole quantum structure.
Exactly, yes. That's a very good way of putting it. It's a sort of a shadow.
Yeah, it's
yes.
A very nice.
Yeah, Rafa.
Basically, you have a preference. Do we think of this as space, or weak rotated space time, or what should we compare this manifold?
Yeah, at the moment it's sort of weak rotated space time, yes. So you're going to ask me how I wick rotate back again, and that, yeah, that's not under control. I have some vague ideas about it, but
instead of that, let me ask you an equally annoying question, I suppose. Now, what about more general topologies? Everything you get here is just the quotient of a Lie group, if I understand. So,
well, you get quite a few.
You normally think that there's a much larger range of available topologies for
space-time. Right. Well, cojoint orbits can have a range of topologies, but not very many. So, yeah, your question is, how do I get other manifolds? And Yeah, I'd really like to know that. And I think to do that, I'd have to drop this Lie algebra hypothesis. So essentially, the role of the Lie algebra here is that I can only keep worrying about a finite number of the generators and what their relations are and sort of drop the rest. But I think a more sophisticated take on this will keep a whole infinite set, you know, the finite dimensional set of relations will grow and get larger and larger, and you'll keep all of them and control them. And that ought to have nothing to do with the algebras now and should give you more manifolds. Yeah, that's a good project.
Okay, so let's thank you, Jonathan. Thank you.